Gary Wurkamp.
And she's Jill Hughes.
Join us for
The Untold Stories of
Shadow Gallery.
Welcome back to episode 4 of Shadow Gallery, The Untold Stories. Today we're going to continue the stories from the band's second album, Carved in Stone, with Gary and Brent as our guest storytellers. But first, the question I am dying to know the answer to after we recorded the previous episode, and also I am sure it is on the fans' minds as well. Gary, you went through this audition process for a band that was supposed to tour Japan and promised you this amazing opportunity. But then the tour fell apart, and you were told you had to write an album with them instead. Were you upset about this? What were you thinking at this time? Or did it not matter, and you were just excited to write music with these talented musicians?
No, I was very excited to have the opportunity to be part of a songwriting team, because that's probably my favorite thing about music and being in a band, is the creation process. And while I was setting my sights on, you know, seeing Japan, I saw this as a great contingency and chance for me to grow as a musician. And I never let on to the other guys in the band that I suspected that they were on a different level than me on a technical basis. But I saw it as a great unexpected fortune of happenstance, and I was looking forward to seeing where we were going to take it.
Well, I'm glad we got that cleared up. So now on to the rest of the stories behind the album, Carved in Stone, and what it was like to record that album. Welcome back, Gary and Brent.
Now, I'm really curious about the recording process and the kind of equipment that you used.
One notch higher than the previous album.
Because, you know, you talked about on the last episodes about how DIY it was and how you had no equipment. So how did that change from the debut album to Carved in Stone?
We took some of the money that we got from Magna Carta for Carved in Stone and bought ADATs, right? That was the new thing. And
we didn't buy them. They just shipped us ADATs and said, here's your royalties.
Is that what it did? Yeah, we had some kind of hookup or something with them or whatever it was. They sent a bunch of ADATs to us, and I think it was like 4 or something, right?
I think it was initially 2, and then we got a 3rd, and then we eventually bought a 4th on our own.
I think, that's what it was. And I remember wasting so much time waiting for these things to sync up.
That's right.
If I could have all the ADAT sync up time back from my life, you know. My God.
Right.
Yeah, that was rough, but it sounded better than the little 8-track reel to reel that we were doing our last one on. That was okay. And once we kind of got used to them, it became, you know, a little quicker, but sonically it got a little bit better. We got better monitors to use. I think that's when Carl bought the Genelec or something, or we got the Genelec system.
We transitioned. We took whatever we had, and just everything was one step better. Not great, but just we bought a Mackie mixing board. Oh my gosh.
Well, it's one better, isn't it?
But yeah, Jill, there wasn't much, but like, you know what? When you're 24, and like, I never had anything for equipment my whole life growing up. So like, to say I own a digital recorder, which means I co-own it with 5 guys, but I have a key to the smelly rehearsal studio.
Cigarette beer house, yeah.
Where I can smoke and record at the same time. And I don't even smoke.
And but I don't have to leave to pee.
Well, that's right. We didn't have a bathroom. We didn't even have a bathroom in that studio.
Yeah, you had to go around the side of it. or the bar up the street.
The Alliance.
Yeah, that's it.
Welcome to the Alliance Bar and Hotel, a place for musicians to go. So I get to the studio one time and I say to Carl, what do you want to work on? And he's like, I don't know. Why don't we,
you want to grab a beer? I'm like, yeah. And like, we never would lock the door because the bar was like 4 doors up. And he locked the door and I'm like, what, are we not coming back? He goes, nah, probably not. We just got out of the bar.
We're going to go play shuffleboard and eat hot dogs.
Oh, we did. Yeah. It's like, that's, you know, it was really good for us and bad for us to have a bar 4 doors away from the studio. But we got it done.
So how long did it take to actually record that album?
I don't know.
That one didn't take as long as the one that came after it.
A year? It was probably a year. Well,
yeah, I think we started in, it was 93-ish.
93,
yeah. Yeah, we started drums at Kevin Safira's house. He was very sick. Yeah,
that was the following April.
Wasn't it?
94.
Oh, I thought it was like a little earlier than that.
I joined in late April of 93, I believe. And then it was all about, like I said, touring and drawing pictures for a while. And then it turned into we got to make the rehearsal studio a real studio.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay.
Right. There was a lot of phases to this, Jill. There was a lot of phases. When we started with Kevin, you know, I think we probably wrote for a year and then recorded for a year. I think that's how that about worked out with Carved in Stone.
We were working with different drummers at that point. Kevin was a last minute Magna Carta session guy, took the drum parts, which were almost entirely written by you, I believe, except for the little pieces I wrote, which wasn't much. And he just charted out what you had programmed and read it, sat there and read it and played it.
Yeah, he was
adding his own incredible parts to it as well, of course.
Yeah, he was expert, just expert level, really, really, really good.
Oh yeah, no, he was like another level.
Yeah, very, very, very good. That's right. You're reminding me now that, and I'm starting to come back to me. We learned about Kevin through Pete Morticelli and Mike Varney.
I think Varney got fed up because we were taking forever to get our drums done, and pretty sure they came in and said, "Call this guy. He's going to do drums for it. He'll do it next week." You know.
Yeah, he just finished a record with Greg Howe, I think it was, right?
Yeah.
And that's how Varney knew him, and I think, and that's how we got to meet him. And luckily he was, you know, relatively close to us.
Everywhere you go, something goes wrong. I mean, was there anything else that went wrong during this recording that you want to share? I mean, what is all the Murphy's Law happenings?
Thank you very much. You didn't even tell any of the bad stories yet. These are all the good stories.
Yeah, well, let's get down to the juicy stuff.
There's nothing juicy about Jim Beam. So let's start there. Brent had quite a collection of Jim Beam bottles, and I was like, I remember going to his house going,
oh my God, yes. Are
you just going to save all those empty bottles? And he looked at me like I was crazy. He goes, yeah, motherfucker, I'm going to save them all. Now shut up and help me get started on another one.
That's right. This album, I'm going to blame it on the album. It truly wasn't me being an asshole, but my girlfriend at the time left me while we were recording this, and I just drank a lot of whiskey. So there was a lot of whiskey being drunk.
Yeah.
And that's what Gary's referring to. And I think when I finally got rid of them all, there might have been 100 or so bottles in there that we had to get rid of.
Wow.
Well, the girlfriends? Oh, well, the bottles.
Well, both after that, yeah.
I also went through a pretty bad breakup.
That's right. Would you also like some Jim Beam?
The epitome of misery, you know, like you want to record, what do you want to do? I don't know, war cry.
It's drinking your sorrows away.
I got to do the solo to War Cry tonight. That's the last thing I want to do.
Yeah.
But no, we got it done.
Yeah, it was rough.
Actually, I got a quick little memory about War Cry. That was... Well, first of all, Brent did the vast majorities of the solos on Carved in Stone. And all of my little solos all have funny stories. This is not one of the funny ones, but I remember recording War Cry. And you know what? I'm not going to sit here and do the same fast, wanky solos that Brent guy does. I'm going to do something different. I'm going to do a harmony, then it's going to be a wah-wah, then it's going to be panned, and I'll go back every two. I was just trying to think of something stupid to do. And I got to the end, and we had to have it done that night for some reason. I don't know. It was always like some stupid deadline.
There's always some dumb imposed deadline.
Right. And I had to go run sound for this band. It was like the band's first gig. They were like 19, but I had to be there. So I had to leave, and I still had 8 more notes of the solo to work out. And you showed up. I was like, Brent, I got to go run sound for this band. I got to go make $60. Can you just, I think it's in F minor. Just play the last 8 notes. And you did, so. Anybody who's listening.
Oh, my God. I forgot about that.
1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. So it's actually 13 notes. You're the last 13 notes.
Oh my God, I forgot about that. Oh Lordy, that's hilarious. That's right. We played a guitar solo together for a second.
Do you remember the first solo I did?
Oh, for Cliffhanger?
How I do. Yes.
Yeah, that was a good one. It was a
you really remember the playback? No, 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 no. Let's talk about this for a second.
That was a good
Let's
one.
Talk about this. No, yeah.
This is another. Hold on a second. Let's make Brent look like the asshole that he was. Story.
No, it wasn't you though. Well, first of all, I'll tell you what the asshole I am. I was like, you want me to record over the world's most boring two chord chord progression? For 8 minutes, you know. Hey, come up with something cool over that. Like, what do you want me to do? E Phrygian? He was like, all right, fine. So you let me, like, you did the, like, three quarters of solo and then you got tired, so you never did the end. So you gave me the very end. And then I came over to listen to it in Carl's old studio. This is the demo. And I'm like, cool, I want to see where they mix me in. What, you know, it's still the sound I got. And we're playing and Brent's playing, you're ripping it up. You did three quarters of the solo and it fades out. And right when my solo starts, it just was about totally faded out. And I looked at Carl and I started laughing. I was, is this a joke? He goes, dude, we got to fade it out. It goes on too long. I was like, what did I do the solo for? And I don't know if you were there or not. I don't remember.
No, I don't remember that at all, but this is a great story.
Probably just shrug your shoulders. Like, I don't know. You know, just play. I don't know what happened. I was drinking Jim Beam.
It's hilarious. Yeah, I don't recall that one at all. That was it.
I mean, for the real album, you were kind enough, or maybe I gave you $100 and we split the solo in half. So I got, you know, a few more notes.
Oh, that's right. We made a demo with the drum machine of the.
Yeah, I'm talking about the real thing.
Now it's coming back to me now. I have no. I wish I had that demo. Do you have that? You should send it to me if you do.
No, I don't have anything from that era. God, no. But the song was going to fade out, but then it took me forever to, like, I'm soloing, and, like, the best thing I did was, like, the slowest thing I did. It was just that little thematic thing at the very, very end. And
yeah.
And Carl's like, well, we can't fade the song out now. We got to get that in there. I'm like, okay, so we go from fading out the second I start to absolutely no fade out whatsoever, so you get every note I ever played. I was like, okay, this band's really confused.
Well, I like that part. It's my favorite part of the song.
I like the rest, which is all the parts you wrote.
Oh, I love you. No, I love you. You're the best. You're the best. It's like we're going to go back and forth between the two of you. So I don't have the liner notes in front of me, but did Carl write most of the lyrics for everything?
Yeah,
I think he wrote all of them. No, I had no interest at all in doing any of that stuff. He was great at it and just took over. Great.
Yeah, I think it was probably all Carl. Maybe Mike might have helped on some stuff. I'm trying to think. No, that's Carl. All those lyrics are Carl.
There's some neat stories on that record, you know. If you look at them, you know, song by song, there's some really neat stories on that record. I'm not going to go into what I think each one of them mean.
Yeah,
but
one of my favorite Shadow Gallery songs is on that record. Cool.
Is it a state?
Yes, it's a state.
And not in the continental U.S.?
It starts with the letter A.
Yeah, I love that song. It was a really... It was a very fun song to record and do, you know.
I think there's a lot of, I mean, I could be wrong. It just sounds like it was your idea, but there's a lot of beautiful, crisp moments on that song.
Yeah, I think I wrote a lot of ways we wrote together were really easy. Like, I would come up with a thing and go, "Hey, can you do something over this?" Okay, that's awesome. Here's this other thing. Can you do something over this? Okay, that's awesome. And now I'm out of parts. And I go, what do you got? And he would just, like, rip off whatever. It was that easy.
Yeah.
It was so easy.
And you know one thing about Chris is he didn't just bang out piano chords. They were always, like, immediately thematic and melodic, you know.
Yeah.
If you're going to play just G and F, he wouldn't just bang out those chords. He would play, you know, very rhythmic and stuff. He was good at that.
Yeah, he was supremely talented. He is. It was that easy, and you know, we put those things together pretty quickly, but But, you know, I later found out that music is cyclical in terms of, you know, how quickly you can forget an idea or get a new idea. You know, that happens to me all the time. And depending on who I'm working with, you know, it goes faster, you know, and working with Chris was usually pretty quick. And same thing with Gary, you know, it's just real, real super easy to come up with real super great stuff. And that's because they're super great musicians and songwriters, composers, heart makers.
I think you need to say the word super one more time.
Put one of those, put a de-esser on me and I'll see it 10 more times.
That's, yeah. That's when I was nominated superintendent of the band.
Assistant to the superintendent of the band. It's a real deal. You know, you don't, not everybody gets to play with people that as talented as I got to play with. So pretty cool.
Yeah, I just want to hear more about the fun times that you had in the beer garage. You know, what was some of the things, I hate to say, what were some of the things that went wrong? But I know you have some really good stories about, like, I think I had heard something, Brent, you wrote on Facebook something, I don't know if it was for this album, something about a door that, like, fell on somebody or... I don't know if that was
God,
the garage door or something. I don't know what that story was about.
It was on me. I'll save that. Yeah, that was. Yeah, it's horrible. That's for Tyranny. I'll save that one for the next podcast.
But we got more stories for Tyranny.
Yeah, we had. Well, here's a goofy story from then. You remember putting those big giant speakers up on those that scaffolding that we had built in the studio? I don't know if you remember that, if we did that before you were with us or not.
No, that was the PA system. Yeah, yeah.
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 So, Jill, we had to lit for whatever reason, we put this giant PA system way up in the air on some wooden scaffolding that we built. It's probably just for space reasons, so we could use, you know, put stuff underneath it or something or whatever. But we built this giant scaffolding, and like six of us are trying to pick this thing up. It had to weigh 400 pounds. It was heavy as hell.
Oh, yeah.
These huge speaker magnets and these gigantic, I mean, 4.5 foot tall cabinets, you know. And they almost fell on us multiple times. Like we could have died easily during that. If somebody's going to get crushed, because there ain't no getting out of the way of that thing, and there certainly ain't no catching it. So that was one time we almost died in there. The other time was when we got smart and thought we would take the spring off of the garage door while it was still under pressure.
We didn't understand the physics.
Yeah, we totally didn't understand the physics, because when you grab the thing, you could just, you know, move it around. That's big old coiled spring. It didn't feel like it had any resistance at all. Of course, it's made out of thick metal, and it's stretched all the way out.
It was probably 1,000 pounds on that thing, and when it flew off...
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Any one of us could have lost a hand, but we didn't.
Or a head.
But it hit the back part of the studio wall, and I remember till the very last day we rented that place, there was a gigantic mark there.
Oh, yeah. It got stuck on the wall. It hit the wall so hard, it got smashed into the wall.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, we could have died there.
So for this, there was no fires, no floods?
Not yet. Well, probably some we forgot about, but not, like, major ones.
Yeah, I think that was about the end of that. I mean, the only thing that really sticks out to me was almost every time I went to go record guitar parts, I would injure a hand or a finger or something. I'd have a cut on my finger, and I'd be wearing a Band-Aid while I'm playing or some bullshit. Like, there was a lot of that. But nothing as epically stupid as what happened in Tyranny.
We had a reverse flood. Can I tell that story, Brent?
No. Yeah, go ahead.
What does that even mean?
So, you know, we would record, I'm going to explain it here. We would record till pretty late, and then we were all still trying to work other jobs at this point, I think. So sometimes you wouldn't want to put the cover on the mixing board and take everything out and put all the tapes back in their cases. And, you know, you'd be like, I'm just coming back tomorrow. I'm just going to leave it. But for some reason, sorry, Brent, I'm really sorry. This is my memory, but it's also enhanced by Carl telling the story so well.
Brent left the master tapes.
Wait a minute. That's a tyranny story. You got to stop there.
Cliffhanger and Crystal and Dream, wasn't it?
No, that was tyranny, bro.
Are you sure? I mean, it could have been any of them.
Sure. We had to go back and re-record a bunch of guitars on that because I killed all the guitar tapes.
But anyway, Brent, he decided to leave the tapes out of the case right on the floor in the exact one-inch spot where our roof sprung a leak and we had the biggest rainstorm in 10 years. So it dripped. Like, just imagine, like, a gigantic garage and there's just one constant drip in one spot and it's dead on all the recording rat tapes.
Oh, my God.
I swear to God, your band is cursed. Like...
Yeah, we had a lot of problems. We had a lot of problems, but you know, I mean, you make your own luck, right? So
a real man makes his own luck.
Yeah,
you're quoting Titanic now.
Yeah, no, I think I'm quoting Bill Parcells.
It does sound like Bill Parcells,
something like that.
Chill. I don't know. I think at some point Carl brought his minister, a priest in, or somebody to, you know, bless the studio because it was just getting worse and worse.
Some Hail Marys and
but.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he did. That's awesome.
Yeah, I don't know. I just
did some exorcisms.
I just noticed there were Bibles in every corner of the studio. Like, why is there a Bible on my guitar? Just read it. Just read it before you record.
That's about what it took. It's probably not a bad idea for that terribly smelly place that we were in.
You know what was fun, Brent? Doubling your guitar tracks. Instead of being smart and you just playing your own parts and doubling them and me doing the same thing, I had to double everything you did, which means I had to learn everything you did.
Yeah, it's a terrible way to do it.
Which was hard. It was really hard. Because you played so fast. I was like, I was just cursing you the whole time, going, son of a bitch, doesn't he just play a whole note? Can you just, you know, because everything was like, all the rhythms were like a little bit on the fast side. And
well, he wanted to be Yngwie.
You and Carl were like, you're pretty meticulous. He if Yngwie had done a lot of cocaine, which actually Yngwie did do a lot of cocaine.
And he was rushing all the time.
Hey, do you know that we started? yeah, that was the other thing. You tend to play ahead of the beat in those days, and I tend to play behind the beat, which means we're both on time, but you had this different excitement. You had this like exciting ahead of the beat, and I was like more of a Pink Floyd laid back guy. So it was like the opposite of my style. So I had to like everything I was going to go play, I had to play it earlier than I wanted to, but at least I got to engineer myself because it started off. I remember we did a Cliffhanger was the first thing I did for the rhythms, and Carl engineered me, and we, you know, played the beginning. I said, "Do it again," and "Do it again." You know, but sometimes he'd say, "Just do it again," and I'd say, "Are you really going to sit here and engineer this for me?" He goes, "Yeah." I said, "Dude, please go get a beer at the Alliance. I can handle this myself."
Give me the sustain pedal, and I will hit punch it.
And he did, and he left, and then he never came back.
Explain that for a second, because so when you're using ADATs to punch in on the recording, just to, you know, to drop the recording head in, you would press down this sustain pedal that was connected to the damn thing, hit play, and then when you're ready to go, you would let the sustain pedal go,
then you're
recording, and as soon as you put your foot back down, you're not recording anymore. That was the genius method of punching in and out back in those days.
I did one thing because I was definitely more of an unorthodox, uneducated recording engineer. And Carl's a brilliant, educated engineer. He's a different school than I am. He's got all this knowledge that I had to learn little by little. But I remember I just couldn't get my guitar because for some stupid reason we're using guitars with Floyd Roses. I couldn't get it in tune. So I tuned the ADAT tape to my guitar, and I started doing it that way. Because, you know, like on a guitar, if you start tuning one string, the other strings go a little bit out of tune. So I was like, I'm perfectly in tune. It's just that Brent and everything else on the tape is sharp. So I'm going to slow down the speed of the ADAT tapes, like maybe 4 cents or 5 cents, just so I can get it in tune. It was a crazy idea, but it worked, you know. You would never know if I didn't tell you. It was a dumb idea, but it worked.
Hey, well, you got to do what you got to do to get done.
You got to do what you got to do. And we got to get on to some fan questions now.
Questions and answers. From Room 5!
And now we have some fan questions. This question is from Johannes Schultz. Gary, you recorded drums on the latest album, Digital Ghosts. So why didn't the band use you as a drummer just as the tour was about to happen and Carved in Stone was released after Kevin had quit?
I wouldn't say Kevin had quit or look at it that way. He came on and did that record, and we were hoping he'd probably stay on and keep working with us. But he got involved in other projects, and you know, we take time in between our records and going out to perform, obviously. So he just was involved with something else. As far as me being the drummer, I'm no Kevin Soffera, and I'm no Joe Nuvolo on drums. I can't play like those guys can. It worked out for some of the songs on Digital Ghosts, but I in no way want to be the drummer for Shadow Gallery.
Another fan question we have is, if you could change anything on the Carved in Stone album, what would you change?
I would turn the bass up a little bit louder on the bass guitar. Also, I would change the snare drum sound from a piccolo to use some other snare that's a little fatter. And then lastly, I would change the segues and not have them individually numbered, but part of the actual songs, because I think that's probably a better way to do it.
This fan question is from Amit Dut. This question is for Carl. What motivated the story behind Cliffhanger?
So, just like many of the songs that I write, my motivation for content tended to be a confluence of multiple points of inspiration or experience. At the time I was writing the lyrics for Carved in Stone, I was an avid mountain climber and tended to take my vacations in places where I could do some aggressive hiking, some challenging ascents, and spend some time either sitting or sleeping out and looking out over the top of the world. And there's always a feeling you get when you're that removed from civilization, that high up looking out over the world, that is quite a bit detached from your normal everyday walk. So I had that in the back of my head. And I always a big fan of spy type movies, kind of leaned on some influence from the movie Where Eagles Dare with Richard Burton and a very young Clint Eastwood. So if you take those things and you kind of mix them up, Cliffhanger was the genesis of, I wanted to A, tie in the idea of, you know, a spy story taking place in my head somewhere, probably in Europe in the Alps, and the idea that while you're on a cliff and you're hanging from a cliff, the story ends with the traditional, you know, the prototype cliffhanger. So I kind of married those two things together, at least with the name and the thought behind it. But I really like the idea of having a storyline that, you know, you have to chase around in your head as the chase is progressing lyrically. So I hope the listeners were able to, you know, kind of latch on to that kind of a vibe and develop for themselves a picture in their head of what I felt when I was really, really high up in a precarious cliff location on top of a mountain, and feel what it felt like to, you know, if you leaned forward, you fell and you die. And I think that in the context of the story of somebody being chased, and not just being chased on the ground, being chased in a place that if you make the wrong misstep, it ends very badly. I think that's a neat emotion to sense from the lyrical construct of the story that is Cliffhanger.
Thank you guys for sharing more stories with us about the recording of Carved in Stone. It's fun to hear how albums were recorded before today's digital technology. Thanks for listening again to our podcast, Shallow Gallery, The Untold Stories. Next episode, we'll wrap up the stories behind Carved in Stone with Gary and Brent and answer some more fan questions. If you have any questions for Shadow Gallery, please send them to shadowgallerypodcast@gmail.com.